He would want retribution. How could he have forgotten? Memories came back to him of the Daveri man, blonde and bluff, who'd befriended him on the road. It was he who had convinced Lovelane to seek shelter in Dunbruthlin. He, this supposed merchant, who looked deep into Lovelane's eyes one night. At that point, Lovelane's memories vanished into the grey fog of wizardry. Only then did he realize just how deeply he'd been ensorcelled, and for months. He wept, throwing himself face down and sobbing into the blankets. Gradually, he became aware of the noise outside. It built on the edge of his mind for a long time before it became insistent enough to take his attention. Men were shouting in anger, running back and forth outside, and horses nickered as they trotted past. It had to be an attack. Lovelane got to his feet just as Corbin threw back the tent flap.
"There you are," Corbin snapped. "Help me, by the hells. Don't lurk in here like a sick hound."
"Watch your tongue when you speak to me. What's so wrong?"
"Kenneth and Kinven are trying to pull their men out. They want to desert the rebellion."
With an oath, Lovelane followed him out. He was terrified, but he knew that he could do naught to prevent them, now that the darkness had deserted him. Nevin sat on the ground in the shade of the wagon. Since his eyes were closed and his shoulders slumped, the servants apparently thought that the old man was having a little nap, because they spoke in whispers whenever they came near him. They could have shouted aloud for all that it would have disturbed his trained concentration, because rather than sleeping, he was meditating. In his mind he held the image of a six-pointed star, a red triangle and a blue intertwined, and used it the way a clumsy Adwayoma man would have used a scrying stone. In the center of the star, images came and went, mental reflections from the astral plane, which embraces the etheric the way the etheric embraces the physical. There, thought forms and images have a life of their own, and it holds memories of every event that has ever happened on the planes below. Through this vast treasure house, Nevin searched, looking for traces of the Dark Master who had become an immediate and pressing enemy. Since the event was so recent, it was easy for Nevin to bring up the images of the last battle, a confusing, flickering, overlapping mob of pictures. At last he sorted through and found Cullen fighting desperately with the squad around him. Nevin froze the picture in his mind, then used it as a seed to let other images gather round it, just as a bit of dust in the air is the seed for a drop of rain. Finally, he saw what he was looking for. Flickering to the center of the star came a presence, a certain blackness, hovering far on the etheric over the battle. When Nevin tried to bring it closer, it vanished. The Dark Master had hidden his tracks well. Nevin broke off the meditation in something like irritation. He hadn't expected to discover much, but he'd had hopes that way. He got up and stretched, wondering what tack to try next, when he saw Aderyn running full tilt back to camp and heading for the tents of the Nobleborn. Obviously, Aderyn had important news, and Nevin hurried after him. Rodri was sitting with Sliggan and Peridir in front of Sliggan's tent when Aderyn arrived.
"My lords! Corbin's broken camp, and he's marching north. I found him a good 10 miles away."
"Ah, curse his balls!" Rodri clambered to his feet. "What's he doing, running for his dun?"
"It looks that way. And here, there's only about 100 sound men with him. I saw only 2 blazons, Corbin's green and tan, and a red shield with a black arrow."
"No X-Men," Sliggan joined in. "So, his other allies have deserted, eh? That's the best news I've had in many a day."
"Then he's bolting for his dun, sure enough," Rodri said. "We've got to catch him. Cursed if I'll have him suing for peace now, and we'll never take Dunbruthlin. Here, if we leave the baggage train behind, we can overtake him late today."
"Normally I'd agree with that," Peridir said, "but Lovelane will know what we're up to. Corbin will have the time to pick a strong position, and there will be charging with exhausted horses."
Rodri felt like cursing him, but it was true.
"Well and good, then. We'll follow him along today and try to catch him on the morrow."
Then he noticed Nevin, standing nearby and listening.
"Here, good sir, you and Aderyn truly should ride near me at the head of the line when we ride."
"Oh, Aderyn can ride where he likes," Nevin said, but I'm going to accompany the wounded back to Dungwerbin.
What?
Here, lad. I haven't told you before, but you've got a worse enemy than Lovelane at your back. I intend to do a rearguard action, shall we say.
Darren can deal with Lovelane, and indeed he has to settle this matter by himself.
Nevin walked off before Rodri could argue further, and for all that he was Cavradoc, he didn't feel like trying to order the old man around. Getting the army fed, packed and moving took well over an hour, which Rodri spent in a fury of impatience. To free his servant for other things, he saddled his own horse and got his gear together, then sent for Jill. He took her over to a cart carrying the mail salvaged from the slain men. Much to his horror, she'd never worn mail before.
Ah, ye gods! How are you going to fight if you're not used to the weight?
I'll just have to get used to it fast, my lord.
Let's pray you can, but this troubles my heart. Oh, by the hairy black ass of the Lord of Hell, I wish you weren't riding with us.
It's your weird, and because of that, I'll kill Corbin sure enough, even if I die with him.
Jill spoke so quietly that he wanted to weep for the shame of it, that his weird would put her in danger. He left her to find a mail shirt and helm, and went out to the horse herd. Among the extra horses he had a particularly fine western hunter named Sunrise, with a coat of the palest gold. He'd been keeping this horse out of the battles, just because it was so valuable, but he was determined that Jill would have him. He saddled Sunrise up with a proper war saddle, then led it back to her. Seeing her wearing mail, with the hood pushed back around her shoulders and her golden hair gleaming in the sunlight, made his heart ache all over again. She was so beautiful, and for all he knew, his weird had doomed her. Jill greeted him with a wry smile.
"You're right about the weight. Ye gods, I never realized that mail was so heavy."
"It's a good 2 stone, sure enough."
He handed her the reins.
"Here, Silver Dagger, here's the horse I promised you."
"His lordship is far too generous."
"He's not. If I have to ask a lass to guard me, then she'll cursed well get the best horse in the whole army."
Jill laid her hand softly on his cheek.
"Rodri, if you didn't feel dishonored by this, I'd scorn you. But if you don't let me fight for you, then you're a dolt."
He turned his face against her hand and kissed her fingers.
"Then I do as my lady commands, and live."
He walked off, leaving her speechless behind him, and his mind was torn this way and that, like leaves driven by the autumn wind, between wanting her and fearing for her life. At last, the army was ready to ride. Alone at the head, Rodri led his allies and his men north, following the road that zigzagged through fields and woodlands, curved maddeningly around farmsteads and rambled through villages that Rodri, in his impatience, felt were placed there just to slow him down. His one comfort was that Corbin was travelling with wounded and thus would have to travel more slowly than he could. Late in the afternoon, he saw lying by the side of the road 2 corpses, some of Corbin's men who died from their wounds as they tried to keep up with the forced retreat. Rodri halted the army, and Sliggin rode up beside him.
"Poor bastards," Sliggin remarked.
"Just that. I wonder how many more we'll find. Corbin's cursed desperate."
"He's got every right to be, eh? We're riding to kill him."
For all that he wanted to make speed, Rodri had some of his men wrap the bodies in blankets and put them into one of the carts. That night, when they made camp, they buried them properly. It was well after sunset when a messenger from Rodri came to Duncanabane. The men on fort guard, just as anxious as Levian was for news, crowded round while the scribe read out the dispatches. When she heard of Dalmia's death, Levian groaned aloud.
"I'm heartsick at this news. He was a good man and a true one."
She paused, thinking things out.
"On the morrow, we'll all ride out. If Corbin's running like a fox to his earth, there's no danger he'll besiege me here. Men, you'll escort me and my women folk to Dungwerbin, then ride after the army."
The fort guard cheered her. Danyan turned her way with a quizzical lift of an eyebrow.
"I want to be nearer the war," Levian said. "If Corbin's allies have deserted him, then they'll all have to sue for a separate peace." I want to be at Dunguerbin to receive them. What if Rhys takes it into his mind to be at Dunguerbin in case they want to sue directly to him?
He might at that. I'd forgotten about Rhys.
I can't. Not for one wretched minute of one beastly day. Once the army had pulled out to chase Corbin, Nevin went to his blankets and slept all afternoon, waking just in time to tend the wounded at the dinner hour. As soon as it was dark, he left the camp and walked to the woodland. He'd been telling Hrodri the simple truth when he talked of standing a rear guard, and to do it he had no need of being physically close to Hrodri any more than the Dark Master needed to be physically close to attack him. Nevin was sure that the Dark Master's body was very far away, at least far enough to flee in plenty of time, should Nevin send armed men after him. Safely hidden in the woods, Nevin went into his trance and up to the etheric plane. Flying faster than any bird, he sped north, until he saw the tangled mass of auras that marked Rodri's army below him. Like a sentry, he hovered above it and circled this way and that as the hours slipped by, unmarked and untellable until midnight, when the astral tide changed from water to earth and the etheric began to billow and churn. Nevin fought and held his place like a swimmer treading water in a choppy sea. Now, if the Dark Master was desperate enough, was the perfect time for him to make an attack. Nevin kept low, close to earth where the billows were less severe. Every now and then he rose up higher, fighting the waves, to get the distant view before he was forced to sink down again. Slowly the waves grew slower, smoother, slowly the billows and churning died away. Just when the tide had finally turned, he saw someone coming to meet him, but it was a Derin, floating along in a simple blue body of light much like his own.
"How goes it?"
a Derin thought to him.
"Dull so far, not a sign of our enemy."
"I've seen naught either. I risked going in this form to Corbin's camp. Lovelay never challenged me."
A Derin's grief swept out like a wave, almost tangible there on the etheric.
"Think of him as dead, my friend."
Nevin put as much gentle sympathy into the thought as he could.
"Mourn him and let him go."
"There's naught else I can do."
Abruptly, a Derin turned away, and following the silver cord, floated down fast to his body. Nevin kept his watch all that night until the aether tide began rolling in a little before dawn. Since no Dark Master could work magic under the tides of aether or air, Nevin returned to his body. As he walked back to camp, he was mulling over his long, boring night. It was possible that the Dark Master was merely holding his hand, waiting until Nevin dropped his guard. Possible, but highly unlikely. Nevin dwelt on the Dark Master, thought of every grim thing he might do, but no Dwayoma warning came to him, not the slightest twinge. From its lack, he knew that the Master had left the field entirely.
"I should have done that last night and saved myself the boredom," he remarked aloud. "But truly, I never thought he'd give up so easily."
All at once he had to laugh at himself. He took his powers so much for granted that he'd forgotten how terrifying they would be to someone with good cause to fear him. The night before, Rodri's army had camped in a common pasture about half a mile from a farming village. Although Hrodri woke everyone before dawn and yelled orders to hurry and get ready to ride, they had to linger for at least an hour, simply to allow the horses to graze. Jill supposed that Corbin was already on the march. He could risk harming his horses because he was headed for his dun. As Jill was drawing her rations, a Derin came up to her and asked her to walk with him a ways. Nearby was a copse of willows around a duck pond, and they went there for a bit of privacy. With a sigh, a Derin sat down on a fallen tree trunk. The brightening light picked out the wrinkles around his eyes and made him look very weary indeed.
"I hope I don't offend you, Jill, but do you truly think you can best Corbin? I won't have you killed in a hopeless cause. If nothing else, Nevin would never forgive me, and his wrath is nothing to invoke lightly."
"Oh, I can well believe that. But as long as it's in single combat, I think I can take him. From what Rodri says, he's old, slowing down, and he's got a good paunch on him. If I can keep him moving, I'll wear him down.
Old? I thought he was but 38.
Well, no offence on my part, but that's old for a fighting man.
I suppose so.
Suddenly the light in the copse dimmed around them. Adairan jumped to his feet and swore as a mass of thick grey rain clouds swept down out of an otherwise clear sky. With a slap, wind hit the copse in a welter of falling leaves. In the distance, thunder cracked and rumbled.
"Is Lovelane behind this?" Jill said.
"Who else? I'll deal with it. Run, child, the horses!"
Under the shadows of clouds, scudding in fast with the cold scent of rain, Jill raced back to the camp and found it in confusion. Men swearing, captains and lords running, yelling orders, the horses dancing at their tether ropes. Just as Jill reached the herd, the first lightning struck, a cracking blue bolt ominously near. Neighing and plunging, the horses pulled at their tethers. The lightning hammered down again. Big drops of rain fell in a scatter. Jill grabbed the halter of the nearest horse and pulled it down just in time to keep it from breaking free. Swearing, the rest of the army was among the herd and doing the same. Rodri came running and grabbed the horse next to her.
"Get ready to run! If they stampede, save yourself and let them go!"
With a slap of wind, the rain poured down, drenching them. The horses danced and tossed their heads as the men pulled them down and talked endless nonsense to soothe them. But that was the end of the lightning, as if the god Tarn had snatched his weapons back from Lovelane. In a few minutes more, the rain stopped with an eerie suddenness. When Jill looked up, she saw the clouds breaking up and swirling in a troubled, gusty wind. For a moment it seemed that they would mass again, as a real storm would have done. But the stretch of blue sky overhead stayed stubbornly clear, then widened as if the clouds were spilled flour and a giant with a broom was sweeping them away.
"Oh, ye gods," Rodri whispered. "Dwayoma."
The last of the clouds dissolved. They did not blow away. They did not thin out and slowly dissipate. They dissolved, suddenly and completely gone. Jill shuddered convulsively. Yet even though Adairan had dispelled the storm, it still slowed the army down. Soggy provisions had to be repacked, wet blankets wrung out, mail rubbed dry, nervous horses soothed. They set out a good hour later than they might have, an hour that meant 3 more miles between them and Corbin.
"We're leaving the carts behind," Rodri snapped. "Jill, ride next to me. We're going all out to catch the bastard."
When Jill rode into line, her heart was pounding in fear. For all that she'd bragged to Adairan, wearing unfamiliar mail was going to slow her down, and speed was her greatest weapon in any fight. Her shoulders ached like fire from the weight. But when Rodri gave her one of his berserker grins, she smiled back at him with a little toss of her head. Cursed if she'd let him see that she was afraid. The army went at a walk-trot pace, which meant they could do 5 miles an hour compared to Corbin's 3. As they rode, Jill looked up constantly, and after a few miles she saw a hawk circling high above them. Her stomach clenched. When the hawk flew away, it headed straight north. They rode on, past farms shut up tight against the doings of warring lords, through fields and woodlands. Jill decided that dying in battle would be easy compared to this clammy fear that clung to her. And yet, in the end, Corbin escaped them. They came to a stubbled field where they saw provision carts, some 10 wounded horses and 14 wounded men, dumped there by their lord to live or die with no help from him. Corbin had left everything behind that might slow him down and was making a run for Dunbrúthlin.
"Ah, horse shit and a pile of it!" Rodri snarled. "We'll never catch them now."
For a long moment he sat slumped in the saddle, then looked up with a sigh.
"Well, no help for it, huh? Let's go see what we can do for these poor bastards. The baggage train and the Kyrurgeons will catch up to us soon enough."
As she dismounted, Jill was thinking that she'd never met a lord as honourable as he. Together they walked over to the improvised camp, where wounded men lay shivering in wet blankets on the ground. Lovelane's storm had swept over them, too. One man stood, leaning against a cart, his head wrapped in a bloody bandage and his right arm splinted.
When he saw Rodri, two thin trails of tears ran down his face.
"What's your name, lad?" Rodri said. "And how long have you been here?"
"Lanik, my lord. And since last night. We all camped here last night and then they left us."
"And did your lord give you any choice in the matter?"
"None, my lord. Or, well, none to the others. I said I'd stay with them. At least I can stand, and I've been trying to feed everybody."
Lanik paused, looking at Rodri with eyes half drunk with pain.
"It was the sorcerer, my lord. Lord Corbin never would have deserted us, but Lovelane made him. I saw it. He ensorcelled him. Ah, ye gods, I'd rather be your prisoner than shut up with that stinking sorcerer."
"Ye gods," Jill said. "I don't blame you a bit."
At the sound of her voice, Lanik sobbed under his breath.
"Alas! Alas, with a sword!"
Then he burst out weeping. The baggage train creaked up about an hour later. Rodri set the two men in Chirurgeons to doing what they could for Corbin's men, but Adaren joined them in the Council of War. The lord stood despondently in a circle and looked at the muddy ground.
"Well, that's torn it," Sliggan said. "Might as well ride on and invest him anyway, eh? It's the honour of the thing."
"True enough," Rodri said. "Well, by the hells, he's probably got messengers on their way to Rhys right now, begging him to intervene. It's going to hurt when my ugly brother calls me off like a hound from the kill."
"Indeed, my lord," Adaren broke in. "What if the messengers never reach him?"
All the lords turned to look at this frail old man, who held power beyond what they could even dream of.
"Lovelane has to be stopped, and now. Do you think Werbred Rhys is going to believe us if we tell him that Lovelane incited this rebellion with Dweilmer? Of course not. And then Lovelane will get off lightly in the Malover by paying a blood price for the man he killed back in our lands, and he'll be free to work more mischief."
"That's all well and good," Rodri said. "But even if we catch the messengers, they'll testify against us to Rhys, unless we kill them. Cursed if I'll kill a pair of helpless men."
"Never would I want you to," Adaren said with a small smile. "Leave them to me, Lord Cavradoc. I won't harm a hair on their heads, but Rhys will never get Corbin's message. I promise you that."
The line of carts carrying the wounded moved slowly and stopped often to let the men rest. At noon, they lingered for a long time, while Nevin and the chirurgeon did what they could. Nevin had just found time to get himself something to eat when he felt Adaren's mind calling to him. He walked a little ways to a tiny brook and used the sun dancing on the water as a focus. Adaren's image built up quickly.
"Did you catch Corbin?"
Nevin thought to him.
"We didn't, blast him. He's going to stand a siege in his dun. Quick, tell me, Summit. You know the politics of Eldith a fair sight better than I do. Suppose Corbin were going to send a desperate message to some ally, asking him to relieve the siege. Who would it be?"
"Oh, come now. Do you really think he'd be that stupid? He should be sending a messenger to Rhys to sue for peace."
Adaren's eyes were unusually sly.
"No doubt he is. But answer my question anyway. I'll explain later when there's more time."
"Well and good, then. Let me think. Talith of Belglaith, no doubt."
"My thanks."
And then the image was gone, leaving Nevin to wonder just what scheme his old pupil had afoot. Because Lord Corbin received coin and taxes from his bridge over the Delondariel, Dunbrothlin was a solid fort, ringed by stone walls, and large enough to house a warband of over 100 men. Although Lovelane usually hated being penned up there, he was glad to reach it that night. As what was left of the army crawled in the gates, Lovelane turned his horse over to a servant and hurried up to his chambers on the top floor of the broch. He threw back the shutters from the window in his bedchamber and leaned out into the clean evening air. He was so exhausted that he was close to tears.
"It was all Adaren's fault," he told himself. "All his fault because he wouldn't let me send the storm like I wanted. Well, maybe the old man won the first skirmish, but there'll be other battles."
"I'm not defeated yet,"
Lovelane snarled in Elvish.
"No, not I. Lovelane the Mighty, master of the powers of air."
But when he turned from the window,
he saw a Darren standing in the middle of the chamber. The image was so clear and solid that Lovelane cried out, thinking that he was there in the body. Only when the vision wavered slightly did he realize that it was a projection, and that he had forgotten to set his astral seals over the dun.
"Lad, lad, my son, please, listen to me. You still have one last chance. I know that someone was working on you, using you. Surrender now and make restitution. If any more men die because of you, you'll be beyond forgiveness. Surrender now while you can still be helped."
Adarin looked so heartsick that Lovelane sobbed once aloud. His father was standing there, offering to forgive him. His father had known all along what he'd only just discovered, that he'd been ensorcelled, that he'd been weak and stupid enough to let himself be ensorcelled by an enemy in disguise.
"Lad," Adarin said, "I beg you."
Shame, embarrassment, a kind of self-loathing, they rose, choking him, turning suddenly to dirty smoke that filled the room and obscured Adarin's image. Lovelane wanted to cry out, to reach out his hand to his father, but the smoke was making him gag, and all at once he was furious, trembling and screaming with rage.
"Get out! Get out! I don't need your help!"
Lovelane called up power and threw a stream of pure force, a barrage of fiery light, but long before it could hit, the image was gone. Lovelane fell to his knees and wept in the midst of the churning, filthy smoke, which slowly, a wisp at a time, cleared of its own accord. It was a long time before he could get himself under control. He rose and staggered to a small table where a pitcher of mead and a goblet stood ready, poured himself a full goblet, and drank it straight down. All at once he could no longer bear to be alone. Goblet still in hand, he ran out of the chamber and hurried down the spiral staircase. Lord Corbin's great hall was a hot, smoky confusion of men, sitting at tables, standing in the curve of the wall, talking in low voices, or merely drinking ale down as fast as the servants could pour it. Lovelane took his usual place at Corbin's right. Across from him was Noek, his eyes dazed as he looked around him. Even though Lovelane had lost the others, he'd been able to keep his ensorcelment upon this lord. Corbin was eating a slice of roast pork, biting into it, then cutting off the bite with a greasy dagger.
"Glad you came down, Counselor," Noek said. "Your lord and I have just been discussing sending messengers to the Guerbret to sue for peace." "He'll grant decent terms," Corbin said, his voice too loud with a false cheer. "But we've got to get the men on their way tonight. I'll wager Rodri invests us tomorrow."
Both men looked expectantly at Lovelane.
"Of course," Lovelane snapped. "You don't need Dweomer to tell you the obvious."
Both lords nodded sheepishly. Corbin fanged his pork and sawed off another mouth-filling bite.
"We need to know exactly where Rodri is," Noek said. "Can't have the messengers blundering right into them."
Corbin nodded his agreement, then belched. Lovelane could stand them no longer.
"I'll attend to it straight away."
As he hurried up to his chamber, he was sweating with fear. He was too afraid of Adarin to scry on the etheric plane, and that meant he would have to fly. Trying to shape change when exhausted was dangerous. Upon entering his chamber, he lit the candle lantern with a snap of his fingers. Seeing the flame spring to his call soothed him. He still had power, more power than those round-eared dogs even knew, him, Lovelane the Mighty. He stripped off his clothes and threw them onto the bed. Not even the mightiest masters of the Dweomer could transform dead matter like cloth. Lovelane laid his hands far apart on the windowsill and stared up at the starry sky until he was perfectly calm. Slowly he felt power gather, carefully he invoked more, until it flowed through his mind like a mighty river. In his mind he formulated the image of the Red Hawk, many times life-size, proud and cruel, then sent the picture forward until it perched on the windowsill between his hands. At this point, the hawk image existed only in Lovelane's imagination, and it was only in imagination that he transferred his consciousness over to the bird. He had spent years on tedious mental exercises that allowed him to imagine that he stood on the windowsill and saw the view below with the hawk's eyes. Keeping his consciousness firmly focused in the hawk, he chanted the power word, a simple hypnotic device that opened the door to the etheric for him. When he saw the view through the cold blue light, he knew that he'd transferred his consciousness up a level. At this point, things had gone beyond simple imagination. When he glanced back, he saw his body slumped on the floor and joined to the hawk with a silver cord. He could have scryed on the etheric with the hawk as a body of light, but he had a more dangerous plan. In his mind, he chanted a second set of words, one that only the Elkian Lakar knew, and saw the lips of his body twitch in rhythm. When he flexed the hawk's wings, the arms below him raised. Now came the true difficulty. The etheric double of every person is like a matrix that holds and forms flesh. If the double is strong enough, the flesh will follow its lead. Lovelane chanted, struggled, bent all his will into the imagining that is more important than imagination, until at last, with one final wail of chant, the etheric drew the physical into its new mould. Lovelane the man was gone from the chamber. Only the hawk stood on the windowsill and stretched proud wings. With a harsh cry of triumph, Lovelane sprang into the night and flew out over the dun. He loved flying, the perfect freedom of drifting on the wind, the view from on high, where every fort and house seemed just a tiny toy, scattered by a child's careless hand. Even in the hawk form, Lovelane retained the etheric sight that was so important a part of the transformation. The countryside below glowed in the bluey night with the reddish auras of the living vegetation. Here and there were daubs of yellow glow, where horses or cows huddled together. Following the coal-black strip of road, Lovelane flew south until he saw the gleaming mass of auras that had to be the men and horses of Rodri's army. Lovelane flew upward to gain height, then circled in a long sweep about the camp. His mind was alert, feeling out the etheric plane for the traces of a Darren's Dwayoma working. When he found none, he assumed that the old man was asleep or busy wasting his time by tending wounds. Then he heard a cry, the soft, mournful note of the owl. With a start and a flap of terror, Lovelane beat hard against the wind and gained more height. He saw a trace of silvery motion below him as the great silver owl sprang out of the trees. In stark terror, Lovelane turned on the wind current and raced for the dun, beating his wings hard and steadily until he was sure he'd left the clumsier owl behind. Yet even though he reached the dun safely, as he settled onto the windowsill, he heard, or thought he heard, a call, one soft note of mourning drifting in the night. Toward noon of the next day, Rodri's army reached Corbin's domain. Everywhere the farmhouses were shut up tight, with not so much as a chicken out in the farmyard. From bitter experience, the farmers knew that the army of even a lord like Rodri would steal any fresh food that came its way. Corbin's dun stood at the top of a low artificial hill, in the middle of a big stretch of open pasture, but none of his lordship's cows were to be seen when the army reached it. Leaving the carts behind, they trotted over, fully armed and ready, in case Corbin stupidly tried to sally, but they found the heavy iron-bound gates shut. Up on the catwalks, men stood half-hidden by the merlons. Defiant at the top of the broch flew Corbin's green banner. Rodri ordered his men to fan out and surround the fort. The investment had officially begun. Just as the carts arrived, Corbin sent out a herald, his aged chamberlain Greymin, trembling even though he carried the beribboned staff that would have kept him safe from even the most murderous lord in all Deveri. When he saw the portly old man puffing down the hill, Rodri dismounted and honourably walked a few steps to meet him, but he made sure he stayed out of bowshot of the dun.
"Greetings, Lord Rodri. My Lord Corbin requests that you withdraw from all his lands."
"Tell your lord that I respectfully decline to fulfill his request. He is a rebel, and under my prescription."
"Indeed?"
Greymin licked nervous lips.
"Even now, messengers are riding to Gwerbret Rhys to sue for his intervention in this affair of war."
"Then I'll wait here with my army until his grace arrives. You may consider yourself under full siege until the Gwerbret personally orders me to withdraw. Tell your lord also that he's harbouring a murderer, Lovelane, his counsellor, and that I demand he be turned over to me speedily for trial."
Greymin blinked twice, then trembled a little harder.
I have sworn witnesses to Lovelane's crimes, Rodri said. If Lovelane is not delivered to me by nightfall, then your lord is twice in rebellion. There's one more thing, good herald. Although I'm determined to prosecute this war against Corbin, I'm extending pardon to Noick and his men. All they have to do is ride out and ask for it.
Greymon turned and fled, trotting as fast as his short breath would allow. Rodri laughed, then walked back, shouting out orders to the army to settle in and start digging earthworks. Needless to say, nightfall came without Lovelane being handed over, but by then the army was firmly entrenched. The carts were drawn up in a circle and guarded by a narrow ditch and bank. The tents were raised and surrounded by a broader one. Armed patrols trotted endlessly round the hill in case Corbin tried to escape. As the men settled down to their well-earned dinner, Rodri and Sligan walked through the camp for an inspection.
"I wonder if any of this will do us the least bit of good," Sligan said gloomily. "It's all very well for a Derren to ramble on about stopping the messengers, but what could he have done? Can't see one old man murdering them on the road, eh?"
After all the cursed Dwayomer I've seen, I'm ready to believe anything. We'll just have to wait and see.
As it turned out, the wait was a short one. Round noon the next day, a guard ran up to Rodri with the news that a noble lord, come with an escort of 12 men, was waiting just outside the camp. The lord turned out to be Talith of Beoglaith, who owed direct fealty to the Gwerbret. Since Rodri could only assume that he was there with a message from Rhys, he was cursing inwardly as he bowed. A man of close to 40, Talith looked shrewdly on the world out of narrow green eyes.
"And what brings you to me, my lord?"
"A very strange business." Talith turned a gesture to his men. "Bring those prisoners here."
When they were led up, Rodri recognized them as two of Corbin's men. They knelt at Rodri's feet and stared at the ground in humiliated shock.
"Did you know that my sister is Corbin's wife?" Talith said.
"I didn't. She has my sympathy."
Talith allowed himself a twitch of a smile.
"I should say she was Corbin's wife. When she and her women came to me at the beginning of this blasted war, I made a vow that she'd never go back to her piss-poor excuse of a husband, even if you didn't hang him. He's driven her mad, stark raving mad. She's been babbling about evil Dwayomer men lurking everywhere, and evil spirits taking Corbin over, until I can't stand it any more."
"By the hells!"
Rodri did his best to look shocked and horrified.
"What a terrible thing."
"So I thought. Well then, yesternight these two ride in with a message from Corbin, asking me ever so sweetly to raise an army and ride to lift the siege."
Rodri whistled under his breath at the gall of it.
"Cursed right," Talith snapped, "as if I'd break the Gwerbret's peace and meddle in summat that's none of my affair, especially after the way he's treated one of my blood kin. If your lordship agrees, I'm going to take these riders down to Rhys and present the matter. Corbin didn't send a letter, you see, so I need their testimony."
"Naught would gladden my heart more. All I ask is that you let me show them off in front of the dun before you go, so Corbin knows that my herald is speaking the truth when he says I've got them."
They went into Corbin's chambers to discuss the news in private. Noick perched on the windowsill, Corbin paced back and forth, and Lovelane sat in a chair and tried to project a calm contempt for this turn of events. Grunting like a pig, Noick repeatedly rubbed his moustache with the back of his hand.
"It was cursed stupid of you to approach Talith," Noick snarled. "I didn't," Corbin snapped. "Can't you get that through your thick skull? I never sent any message to Talith. I sent those two men to Abawin to sue for peace, just like we decided."
Lovelane swore in Elvish.
"A traitor," Corbin went on. "There has to be a traitor in the dun, and he judged Talith's mind to a nicety, too." "And just who would this traitor be?" Noick said. "There's no one here but us and our men, and I can't see your two lads singing that up on their own." "Just so."
Corbin stopped pacing to turn on him.
"I was wondering about that myself. I'm not the one who received the offer of pardon."
When Noick's hand drifted toward his sword hilt, Lovelane jumped up and got in between them.
"Don't be fools," Lovelane snapped. "It would have been extremely easy for Rodri's men to take the messengers on the road and bribe them then and there."
Corbin sighed and held out his hand to Nowick.
My apologies. I'm all to pieces over this.
And so am I.
Nowick shook his hand.
Well, can't drink spilled ale, can you? The question is, what do we do now?
I haven't given up hope yet,
Corbin said with a flattering smile at Lovelane.
Maybe there are other ways to send messages, ones that don't require horses.
Lovelane felt sweat spring up on his back. Darren was right outside, waiting and watching for him to try to escape.
Perhaps, Lovelane forced out a smile. His lordship has been pleased with my subterfuges in the past.
Corbin smiled. Nowick began running his fingers through his moustache as if he meant to tear it out.
If my lords allow, Lovelane went on, I'll retire to my chamber and consider the problem.
Lovelane ran up the staircase to his chamber, barred the door behind him, then flung himself down on his bed. All his talk of Rodri's bribing messengers was just so much chatter to keep up the two lords' morale. He knew that Adarin had to be the one behind the ruse. It would have been easy for the old man to ensorcel them and inject an image into their minds, to plant a clear and vivid memory of Corbin telling them the message to Talith. They would have no way of discovering that the memory was as false as a dream. He got up and paced restlessly to the window. Maybe he could reach the Guerbret with the message. He could put Corbin's letter and some clothes into a sack that the hawk could carry in its talons, then somehow evade Adarin and fly to Aberwyn. Somehow. He laughed, an hysterical giggle, knowing that no matter how fast he flew, Adarin would be following behind. Unless, of course, he killed Adarin first. He clutched the windowsill hard with both hands. To kill your own father. Oh, ye gods, had he come this low? Lovelane flung himself down on the bed again. All afternoon he lay there, and his mind was as choppy as the sea when the tide runs one way and the wind another. Since there was a chance that Corbin would make a desperate sally now that his messengers had been apprehended, everyone in Rodri's camp went armed that afternoon. Jill joined Calendariel and Jennatar, who were standing guard over the horses with their longbows ready. As the hours dragged by, even the two elves were hard-pressed to find jests.
"You know, Jill," Jennatar said, "I've been thinking about our Lord Rodri ever since that little scrap he had with Cal here.
There's something about the way he moved and how quick he was that's suspicious. Would you do summat for me? See if you can get him to touch your silver dagger. I wager it glows."
"What's the old saying?" Jill said. "Elven blood in Eldith veins."
"Oh-ho!"
Calendariel joined in.
"You think, lass, unlike the rest of the stinking round ears."
"Would you not use that word?" Jennatar snapped. "It's more than a little discourteous, especially in front of Jill."
"Now, Jill may have round ears."
Calendariel pointed at one of them with his bow.
"But she's not a round ear. There's a big difference."
Jennatar growled like a dog.
"Oh, very well. I won't sully your pointed ears with the word again."
Cal ducked back as the other elf swung a fake punch at him.
"But truly, Jill, see what happens when Rodri gets that blade in his hands." "I'll do my best," Jill said, honestly intrigued. "And as soon as I can, too."
By then it was nearing sunset, and the fading light made a sally impossible. When Rodri called off the guard, Jill and the two elves went back to camp. Since everyone was expecting a long siege, the elves had raised the tent they'd brought on their travois. It was a beautiful thing, about 10 feet across and 8 high, made of purple-dyed leather and painted with pictures of running deer in the forest, so realistically done that Jill could have sworn that the deer would turn their heads and look at her. While Jennatar went to draw rations for the three of them, Calendariel helped Jill off with her chainmail. She felt as if she were floating just by contrast.
"I pray to every god in the sky that Corbin doesn't sally before I get used to this miserable stuff."
"So do I."
Calendariel looked sincerely worried.
"You might ask Adarin for some ointment if your shoulders are sore."
"You know, I think I will."
Adarin did indeed have a rubefacient mixture in sweet lard that took some of the ache away.
Jill went into the comfortable privacy of the tent and rubbed the minty-smelling salve into her shoulders and upper arms, then merely sat there for a while to rest. Now that she was faced with the hard reality of war, she was frightened, thinking that her father was right enough. She knew nothing of the screaming, shoving confusion of a real battle.
"It's too late now to get out of it," Jill remarked to the grey gnome. "And better dead than a coward."
The gnome yawned in unconcern. She supposed that he could have no idea of what death meant.
"Jill?"
It was Rodri's voice.
"Are you in there?"
"I am, my lord. I'll come out."
But Rodri slipped in just as she put on her shirt and was grinning in triumph at catching her alone. The gnome opened its mouth in a soundless snarl as he sat down beside her.
"This tent is splendid. I wanted to look at the inside."
"I never knew that the Lord Cavradoc had an interest in leather cushions and tent poles."
"A very great interest."
Rodri inched a little closer.
"Why, I don't think I've ever seen finer cushions than these."
The gnome leapt up and slapped his face. Rodri swore and looked around for the source of the blow, but the gnome jumped onto his back and grabbed handfuls of his hair. With a yelp, Rodri batted at the enemy he couldn't see.
"Stop that!"
Jill snapped. With an audible hiss, the gnome disappeared. Rodri gingerly rubbed his scalp.
"In the name of every god, what was all that?"
"I don't know, I'm sure. Are you having spasms? Maybe you should consult with a Derin."
"Don't give me that."
Rodri grabbed her wrists.
"You know cursed well what happened. Why else did you yell stop that at whatever it was?"
Jill twisted against his thumbs, broke his grip, then started to scramble up, but he caught her by the shoulders and dragged her back. For a moment they wrestled, but Jill began to giggle and let him win.
"Answer me," Rodri said, and he was smiling. "What was it?"
"Oh, well and good then. It was one of the wild folk, and he was jealous of you."
Rodri let her go and sat back.
"Are you daft?"
"You felt it pull your hair, didn't you?"
Rodri looked at her with such revulsion on his handsome face that she suddenly hated him. She pulled her silver dagger and held it close to him. The light ran like water down the blade.
"Oh-ho! Elven blood and Eldith veins indeed! Don't you look so snot-faced about me! I may see the wild folk, but you're half an elf."
When Rodri grabbed the dagger from her, it flared as brightly as a sconce full of candles. Swearing, he turned it this way and that while Jill laughed at him.
"It's got an enchantment on it. It glows round the Elkian Lakar, and that's who the West folk really are. You're half one of them, I swear it."
"Hold your tongue."
Rodri flung the dagger down.
"And don't you laugh at me."
The order, of course, only made her laugh the more. Rodri grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her so hard that she slapped him across the face.
"You little hellcat!"
Shoving and swearing, they wrestled like a pair of wild things, but he was the strong one when her fighting tricks were of no use. Finally, he pinned her on her back, lay half across her, and smiled, his face only a few inches from her own.
"Cry surrender."
"Shan't."
He bent his head and kissed her. It was the first kiss a man had ever given her, and it seemed to burn on her mouth, as if she were aflame with thirst, and only Rodri's kisses could slake it. She slipped her arms around his neck and kissed him again, open-mouthed and greedy.
"My pardons, Lord Cavradoc,"
a Derin said.
"But is this truly wise?"
With a yelp, Jill shoved Rodri away and sat up. His arms crossed over his chest, a Derin stood over them, and he wasn't smiling. Rodri turned scarlet and sat up too, smoothing his shirt down.
"From the noise in here,"
a Derin said with great asperity,
"I thought I'd have to break up a fight. What are you two, cats squalling with love in a barnyard? By the hells, Jill, I've got to answer to both Nevin and your father about you. I don't care to face either of them in a rage."
Neither did Jill. She wanted to melt like spring snow and sink into the earth with shame. Rodri forced out a sheepish smile and picked up the silver dagger, which promptly glowed in his hands.
"I know what you're going to say, good Adarin.
Rodri said, fiddling nervously with the dagger hilt.
And you'll be right, too. It would be a shameful thing of me to dishonor the woman I love in the middle of an army camp. I had no intentions of doing anything of the sort.
There are times, Adarin said, when I truly wish I could turn men into frogs. It's a bit hard to believe those fine words.
All at once, Adarin stopped and stared at the dagger. Jill supposed that he was so used to Dwayoma that he'd only just noticed the enchantment on the blade.
So, it's an odd thing about elven blood in a clan. It skips generation after generation, and then all at once, out it comes in someone.
What? Rodri squeaked. What cursed nonsense?
No nonsense at all. Jill, take that dagger back. You're coming with me. As for you, my lord, think about this. I know it's a bit of a shock, but you're as much kin to the Elkian Lakar as you are to the Maelwith clan.
Just that evening, the wagon train with the wounded and the prisoners reached Dungwerbin. Standing on the crest of a hill, the Dun towered over the little town that had grown up around the Tyrant's principal residence. Inside the Dun walls were a triple broch and enough huts and houses for a village. Although Nevin was pleased to learn that Levian had already arrived, he had no time to talk with her for some hours. Together with the official chirurgeon, he oversaw getting the wounded bunked down in the barracks, changed the dressing on everyone's wounds, then bathed before he went to the Great Hall. At the door he met Lord Gwynveth, the Chamberlain, a highly efficient man, despite having lost his right arm in battle years before.
"I followed Rodri's orders about the silver dagger. He's in a chamber in the broch, and the chirurgeon's already seen him."
"Splendid. I'll look in on him myself in a bit. Where have you seated me for meals?"
"At the table of honour, of course. Her Grace is there now, and she wants a word with you."
The Vian's great hall was easily 100 feet across. In between the windows, tapestries hung on the wall, and the floor was covered with neatly braided rushes. Levian rose to greet Nevin, and seated him at her right hand. Since everyone else had long finished eating, a servant brought him a trencher of roast pork and cabbage, and a tankard of dark ale.
"Nevin," Levian said, "where's Jill? Several people now have told me she's with the army, but that can't be true."
"I'm afraid it is. Have you heard of the Dwayoma prophecy? That's true, too."
"Oh, ye gods, I thought everyone had gone daft."
Levian took his tankard and helped herself to a sip of ale.
"Truly, I'm as worried about Jill as I am about Rodri. It was odd, considering how short a time she sheltered with me, but I've never met a lass I liked more."
Nevin merely smiled, thinking it was hardly odd at all, considering how deeply Levian's weird had been entwined with Jill's in lives past. After he finished eating, he went to his chamber up in one of the joined towers. A page had already brought him a pitcher of water and started a charcoal fire in the brazier to take the damp off the stone walls. Nevin opened the shutters over the window for a bit of air, then stood over the glowing coals and thought of Adarin. In a few minutes, Adarin's image appeared, floating over the fire.
"I was going to get in contact with you later,"
Adarin thought to him.
"I've just found out an interesting thing. I saw young Rodri holding Jill's silver dagger, and it was glowing like fire. All the elven blood in the Maelwith's clans come out in him."
"By the gods! Of course! I should have seen that years ago. It explains many an odd thing about the lad."
"It's a hard thing to spot about a man sometimes. I suppose that's why the dwarves developed that Dwayoma for their silver. I'm more concerned with keeping the lad alive than ever. When the time comes for the reconciliation of elves and men, it will be useful to have him Tyran on the western border."
"Useful and twice useful. I've always had strange omens about the lad, and I wonder if this lies at the core of them."
"It might, at that. And truly, I wonder if Rodri's elven blood is what made him so interesting to our dark enemy."
"Indeed? Why?"
Adarin hesitated, looking puzzled.
"I don't know," he said at last. "The thought just seemed to come to me." "Then it's an idea worth pondering. You may have been given a message.
After Adairan broke the link, Nevin paced back and forth and wondered if indeed Rodri was the man meant to mediate the ancient feud between elf and man. It's difficult in the extreme for the Great Ones, the Lords of Weird and the Lords of Light, to communicate with their servants on Earth, simply because those disincarnate beings inhabit a plane far removed from the physical, far more deeply within the heart of the universe than even the astral plane. If one of the Great Ones has to send a message, he has to work a Dwayomer of his own, first building a thought form that's roughly the equivalent of a Dwayomaster's body of light, then using that form to travel down the planes to the lowest level such a being can reach. From that plane he can then either direct the elemental spirits to produce certain effects, such as thunder from a clear sky, or else send images, emotions, and with great difficulty, short thoughts, into the mind of the person trained in Dwayomer. If one of the Great Ones had gone to such effort to send Adairan a message about Rodri's elven heritage, then something very important indeed was at stake. As Nevin thought about it, he could see that the Dark Dwayomer might have some interest in ensuring that peace never came to the elven border, simply because those who follow the dark arts are safer in troubled times, when lords can't be bothered with tales of peculiar people who do suspect things in out-of-the-way places. And yet, the reason wasn't quite adequate. Unlike the evil magicians in the bard songs, who love to cause misery and suffering for its own sake, the men of the Dark Dwayomer never act directly in the world without some very good reason. If a Dark Master wanted Rodri dead, it had to be because Rodri presented some specific threat to him or to his kind. It was puzzling, all of it, and Nevin knew that he had many hard hours of meditation ahead of him if he was going to begin to sort the puzzle out. He was sure that he had more clues than he could easily see, and that the roots probably lay deep in his own past and in the past lives of those in his care.
I grow so old and so weary.
Whenever Nevin looked over his life, the memories were crowded and tangled, as if he were looking at the wrong side of a tapestry and trying to figure out the pattern on the front. Quite simply, he'd never had the chance to sort things out in the state called death, where the experiences of a lifetime are sifted and condensed to hard, clear seeds of experience. Everything ran together and blurred, until at times he could barely remember the names of people who had been important to him, much less why they had been important, simply because the information was sunk in a sea of meaningless details. At other times, when he was trying to make a decision, the memories crowded so thickly that he could barely act. Every possible course of action would immediately suggest three or four possible different results that had happened or might have happened in the past. Every fact became qualified 100 times over, like some passage from a bardic poet, when adjective after adjective clusters round and overwhelms one poor little noun. In truth, as he considered the problem that night, Nevin realized that he thought very much like an elf.
So be it. It's not my will anyway, but the will of the light.
Fortunately, he had too much work on his hands to sit and brood. He gathered up his supplies and went for a look at Cullen, whom he found awake, lying propped up on pillows. A servant had lit the candles in the silver sconce on the wall.
"Nevin!" Cullen snapped. "I just heard! Ye gods! How could you lie to me that way?"
There was only one thing he could mean.
"Who told you she's with the army?"
"The cursed chirurgeon! Ye gods! He's cursed lucky I'm too sick to stand, or I'd have taken his head for this! How could you lie to me?"
"There wasn't anything else I could do. She was determined to go, and I didn't want you upsetting yourself."
Cullen growled under his breath. He was close to tears.
"Did our fat-mouthed chirurgeon tell you of the prophecy, too?"
Cullen nodded a yes.
"She's most likely going to kill Corbin," Nevin went on. "The whole thing has the ring of weird to me, and she's your daughter, after all."
"She's never been in a battle. How could Rodri? I save his cursed life, and this is how he repays me. I swear it, if she dies, I'll kill him. I don't care what his ugly clan does to me for it, I'll kill him."
What might have been a boast from another man was the simple truth coming from Cullen of Caermore. Nevin felt trouble sweeping over them all like a breaking wave.
"I thought I liked the lad,"
Cullen went on. I was fool enough to think I honoured him.
Hush, you can't do anything about it now, and you're just upsetting yourself.
Hold your tongue, old man. I don't give a pig's fart if you're Dwayomer or not. Just hold your tongue.
At that moment he sounded so much like Geraint,